next parts of Leviticus. We have been talking about the food, the regulations with regard to diet. That's only part of the laws of cleanliness. Now, Mr. Lee spoke to me, and maybe I should pick up on something that he said and emphasize it where he has a real point. That these laws, I have spoken of them as laws of hygiene. But understand, these laws of hygiene were given by God. And they were given by God for the priests to administer. And there were sanctions, religious sanctions, if you didn't do them. And in short, God gave them spiritual significance. If you did not do these things, people didn't know that this was just for public health. I think the people did know that you did not get an automatic blessing. Hezekiah violated the Passover standards because of necessity and said, "The good Lord pardon everyone who orders his heart to seek the Lord, even though he is not clean according to the commandment of the sanctuary." Heart, the Old Testament is heart religion. Let's not forget that. It wasn't a religion of do this and don't do that and you'll be safe. It was a heart religion. The promise of Deuteronomy and the promise of Jeremiah is, if you do these things, the Lord will circumcise your heart. Now, that's the Old Testament. Of course, that's what Paul says in the New Testament. The New Testament is, he is not a Jew who is one outwardly. It is not circumcision which is of the flesh, Romans 2, 15. But that is circumcision which is of the spirit and of the heart. And so all of these laws had spiritual significance and were given spiritual significance, but they were given spiritual significance, God knowing that they were of good for the nation in public health. And God's blessing was that if they would obey his word, he would take off from them the diseases of Egypt. None of the diseases of Egypt. Egypt was full of parasites. In Egypt, they had snail fever, I think I mentioned. Snail fever, until recently, was fatal. And you got it even if you went swimming in polluted water. Most of it was polluted water. So parasites were a very real problem in ancient times. But the people didn't know all of these details, but they did know that God would bless them if they obeyed his will, and so they had spiritual significance. I don't want to deny that when I emphasize the hygienic. That's a good point. Now, the next thing is in Leviticus chapter 14 and 15. This is the passage which in the King James says it's leprosy. These are the regulations for the diseased person if the person has been healed of his leprosy in verse 3. Now, the NIV translated that infectious skin disease. Now, there's been much discussion about that, of course. Leprosy, the Septuagint here, has the word lepra. Of course, this would be the ancient Greek interpretation. The question then is, what does lepra mean? Lepra in the Greek doesn't necessarily mean leprosy in the English, though they are related. If we use the word Hansen's disease, what we call leprosy technically is Hansen's disease. And it is caused by a particular, bacillus, particular germ. And it comes on slowly. And it affects the nerves, it affects the body in various ways, two kinds of it. So we're not interested in details, but leprosy is a disease that comes on slowly and you don't recover from it. That's part of the sad condition of leprous people. The fingers get drawn and the fingers stop off, they feel no pain. And the finger gets infected, it drops off, and they don't even know it's infected, gone. They feel no pain, and the result is they're disfigured, and it's a very sad disease, of course, leprosy. But this is different. Here you have something on your skin, redness, sore, some kind on your skin, and you come and see the priest. And he looks at it and says, oh man, that's bad. That looks bad. Oh, it's got stuff in it and all. I've got to say, go home, take two aspirins. You go home and see me in 7 days. But he said, don't go home. Go outside the camp. This is quarantine. You go under quarantine for 7 days. And then come back. And he looks at it and says, well, now you're making progress. That looks a whole lot better. Yeah, does it hurt? Well, I tell you, I think it's going to get well. You stay another 7 days. And he comes back and says, ah, yes, I thought so. It's all right. Go home now. But first you have to wash. And if it's in your head, well, you have to shave your hair, and wash your clothes, and then you can go back to your people. Now, see, it has two things, the quarantine and the washing. Now, the washing, of course, he didn't say wash it with Carl Dakin's solution or put on iodine or methylate or something. He didn't have those things. But to wash the wounds or the sore, wash off as much as possible, wash your clothing. Well, one of the best things for public health is washing. And so but this does not describe leprosy. This describes something like measles or scarlet fever or smallpox or maybe diphtheria. I don't know all the things it does describe. I'm not the doctor, as you may be. But at least the descriptions here refer to a group of diseases, some of which are benign and some of which are fatal. And the priest couldn't tell which was benign and which was fatal. All he could do was to prescribe quarantine and hope for the best. And so this is what he must do. A person to be cleansed must wash his clothes, shave off all his hair, bathe with water, and then he will be ceremonially clean. After this, he may come into the camp, but he must stay outside his tent for 7 days. And so on. So there's a regimen, and the regimen is cleansing. Now, also, there was an offering. Now, it doesn't mean that sickness is sin. But it is true, of course, that sickness is the result of sin. So it's not illogical to ask an offering. And the offering, of course, gives you the religious sanction to enforce the laws. The priest was the public health officer. Nowadays, a public health officer, he puts on a stand. And then you can go or do. But in those days, the priest was a public health officer, and in case of unnatural sickness of one kind or another, there was a sacrifice prescribed. And this fits in with the idea that that God gave a spiritual meaning to the answer, as an answer to the sin, to the sickness. Sickness, you pray about your sickness. You pray about your sickness, and God hears your prayer, and God heals. And though we've got doctors, and though we have hospitals and everything else, we better pray too for our sickness, that the doctor's medicine will take effect, because sometimes the doctor's medicine will kill you. Yes, yes.
Do you not think that a sickness is a result of a sin?
Not a specific sin, but a sin in general. Yes. Adam and Eve didn't have it. Till their later life. Now the details here I don't think we need to go into. There's a sin offering, guilt offering, various types. Not the thanksgiving offering, not the burnt offering that's involved sometimes, but particularly the sin and guilt offering. On the eighth day, in chapter 14, on the eighth day for his cleansing, he comes in, and some of the lamb of the guilt offering, some of the blood is put on the lobe of the right ear and the thumb and the toe. Now that's the same way a priest was dedicated, you remember? The ordination of a priest, also the oil, anointing oil, was to go on the ear, the thumb, and the toe, what was left over on the head. And this is dedication of the whole person. Symbolic, of course. The symbolic of the whole person. So, then sacrifice, and then that's a section in chapter 14. So I think that it is pretty well recognized today that the sickness here is not leprosy, Hansen's disease, technically. Now, that's interesting because sometimes the Bible is blamed for the bad condition of lepers. Lepers, you know, for years have been isolated, quarantined. And there have been people who said that this is an awful thing. The Bible has quarantined lepers, and they say leprosy is not communicable. You didn't have to quarantine lepers. These poor people were left off by themselves with nobody to even get them groceries. And they were living in poverty and need, and all because of the old superstitions of the Bible against leprosy. Now, I suppose there's some truth in that. Christians who didn't know anything in ancient days, they did isolate lepers, and they did take the translation leprosy, because the Greek says lepra, and it did apply it to leprosy. And whether leprosy is communicable or not, it's not easily communicable, and it wouldn't be done in 2 weeks. So there's been some hardship caused, I think, by misinterpretation of the Bible. And we ought not to blame the Bible with our misinterpretations. Leprosy is communicable. After all, people get it. Get it from somewhere. I think it's particularly communicable to young people, children, maybe babies. But it is also true that a person may have leprosy for a long, long time. Yes.
How was the Hebrew household used to the time of the
sacrifice? How was it understood? Well, it was understood as the Greek word lepra. But the Greek word lepra, I don't know for sure what the Greek word lepra means. It probably included leprosy. They did have leprosy in ancient days. Remnants of leprosy, true leprosy. And I don't say there's no leprosy in the Bible. Gehazi, leprosy, probably was leprosy.
They use a hamsor for Hezekiah?
For Hezekiah? In Isaiah 38, you mean? Yeah. I don't know. No, I don't think so. That was the word boil. I think that word in Hebrew would be shekin there. Job was shekin, boil. And we don't know for sure what shekin means. Boil, carbuncle, scrofula, we don't know what it means. So to ask what leprosy meant then is kind of difficult because they didn't know either what lepra meant. Or what was lepra and what was not lepra, you see. So there was leprosy. And it was also tuberculosis and other things. And whether the Greeks, of course, had positions, fairly decent positions. I mean, as far as an outside looking is concerned. I can't tell you. You probably should look at a big Greek lexicon like Liddell and Scott. Liddell and Scott's the Greek-English lexicon. Why don't you do that? Look it up for us. Okay. Now, we go on with chapter 15. And chapter 15 is a difficult chapter.
The offering that was offered was... Could that have been because they were unable to offer an offering
during the time they were in quarantine. I read that somewhere, I think.
Well, it could be, but you know, people didn't just come day by day and offer guilt offerings. A person could go for months and not offer a guilt offering. And so for him to offer a guilt offering at the end of this time would not be necessary because he had not been, because he'd been denied for 2 weeks. I don't think that would wash. I think so. No, I think it's better to say that it was a signal that God had answered his prayer and that the defilement symbolized by the disease was done away. Yes.
The rationale between the NIV's infectious disease. Why the addition of the word infectious?
Well, the idea is it's contagious because that's why they're quarantined. Yeah. Infectious, contagious, the same word. Actually, I think infectious, contagious, I think technically means you get it easy. And infectious means you can get it. It's more broad, I think, the word infectious. Check me on that.
Yeah. Chapter 14, verse 45, four verse, I think I see three important, destroy the whole house.
Yes.
And I think called it a mildew of tears.
Yes. Yes.
Comment on that?
Yes, I slipped over that and I shouldn't have done so. Verse 33 and following, the NIV calls that cleansing from mildew. The King James calls this leprosy in a house and leprosy in a garment. And you see, Hansen's disease does not affect garments. And Hansen's disease does not affect houses. What is it that affects a house and a garment that is bad and makes you throw it away? It's mildew. And the same word is used here for leprosy as the other. But with regard to people, we didn't call it mildew. Most people aren't afflicted with mildew. But houses, dry, damp places, leather, rainy season, during the monsoon and so on in India, everything gets mildew. Now, mildew is not very healthy. And if a house is built in a place where it's damp and mildew and things get rotten, it's not a very healthy place to live. And a house like that, the owner goes and tells the priest, says, I have seen something that looks like mildew in my house. Now, maybe it's a rented house. It's the renter that goes and tells the priest. And the owner likes to face it. But the priest goes in, and what does he do? He sees it, and it's probably either a stone or a mud brick house, and he scrapes it. Well, he washes it off with Lysol. I mean, that's what you would do in the bathroom. But he didn't have any Lysol, so he just scrapes it and washes it, cleans it up, opens the windows maybe. Remember, of course, they didn't have windows that opened and shut the way we do. They had slits in the wall, sometimes shutters. Then he would watch it for a while. And if it didn't come back, why, they'd plaster it over and fine, it's fixed. But if it wasn't fixed, if the mildew came back, and the place was in a position where it would be unhealthy, by then they were not supposed to live there. So the house was condemned. It's pretty decent order, you know. Same way with a garment. Here you've got a jacket. And this jacket, you had it hanging on the peg for a while, and it was a wet place and a wet day and all, and you come out and smelly and green all over. And what do? Well, you wash it. And if, of course, it's under the supervision of the priest. And if it's all right, then you air it in the sunshine okay. But if not, well, you cut that out. If it spreads to the other part of the garment, throw it out. It's a good rule for things that would be unhealthy to wear or to live. And we call it mildew because, as far as we could tell, that's what it was. Now, the Hebrew words are broad, you know, and we have to identify from the context. Good. The Then chapter 15 deals with discharges, sexual discharges and others. And the first part, discharges causing uncleanness. Verse 15, chapter 15, verse 1. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, speak to the Israelites and say to them, when any man has a bodily discharge, a discharge is unclean. Whether it continues flowing from his body or blocked, will make him unclean. And how is discharge to bring about uncleanness? Any bed the man lies on, someone unclean, and his clothes no unclean. Anything touches his bed unclean till evening. Anything he sits on will be unclean till the evening. Whoever touches him will be unclean till the evening. If he spits on someone who is clean, he must wash his clothes to be unclean till the evening. But he sits on riding and so on. Now it says any man with a discharge. Now here is the question whether this is a sexual discharge. And I think most people think that it is. I don't. Any man here, the word in Hebrew is translated, I believe. No, this is not the one I assigned. The Hebrew here is ish. Any person. And it could be, you know, male or female. And it's not clear. Now, in verse 16, it is male. When a man has an emission of semen, he must bathe his whole body with water, be unclean to the evening, and so on. There, it is male. But this one is not. And it doesn't say so. My argument would be, and there's some support this, some do not. And my argument would be that this first portion, say 15:1 to 15:15, that this refers to diarrhea. Diarrhea was a sign of a serious disease. Cholera. What is cholera? A plague. And cholera includes diarrhea. And it is terribly contagious. And this person is unclean. What he touches is unclean. Any contact with him is unclean. This would be the best possible rules to avoid a plague of cholera. Best that they knew. Handle it better now, but they didn't have antibiotics in those days. So I would take this first one to be the diarrhea discharge, and it is a sickness, and a serious sickness. And of course, if he's unclean, and at the end, on the eighth day, we hope that he's still unclean the eighth day. If he isn't, he's dead. Cholera killed pretty quickly. By the eighth day, he brings in his two turtle doves and gives them to the priest for a burnt offering. Now, in verse 16, any question there? You see my point?
Is cholera common to the geographical?
Oh, yes, it's a place. Of course, you would say that geographical place, you have to say that geographical ancient place. And it's awfully hard to discharge. Few doctors like to diagnose over the telephone. And here, we don't even have a telephone. So to diagnose in a distant place in ancient day is not easy. But that there was no cholera in ancient days would be difficult. We know that there was bubonic plague. And that the cholera would be part of such. It wouldn't have to be limited to cholera. Any diarrhea. It is to be noticed, though, that the reference to the emission in verse 16 and the reference also to menstruation in 19, for man and woman, the normal emissions here, the cure is that they bathe in water and are unclean until the evening, and there is no sacrifice or turtle doves or anything that is expected or required. That is interesting. And there's another interesting point that I hadn't caught until where I was reading, I don't think with Harrison, but one of the books. Where it was. And one other interesting thing here. you realize what a law like this would do for prostitution? And not only prostitution, but particularly temple prostitution. The ancient Near East was full of temple prostitution. And boy, this would be aimed at that. Sure enough, a prostitute would be perennially unclean. And for prostitution to be engaged in a religious sense in the temple, the way the Canaanites did all the time, would be ruled out completely by this. So it certainly had spiritual consequences. And it had moral implications too. But these two, what you would call normal sexual matters. There's no requirement of the sacrifice or anything. Wash and be unclean until the evening, and that was it. When it comes to unnatural, when a woman's bleeding or anything continues beyond normal situations, unnatural bleeding, unnatural problems, there is sickness. And doesn't go into details, of course, but there is sickness. They didn't know what sicknesses there would be, but at least those could continue for years. Of course, it gives you an idea of the sad situation of that woman in the Gospels who had had bleeding, but was it for 12 years? I get mixed up. The woman was troubled in her back with 18 years, I think. And for 12 years, here she was, unclean, and in her difficulty, and Jesus healed her in his mercy. So, yes.
The turtle doves that are off. Where are these people with the turtle doves? Do they keep them, or do they just go out and grab a picture?
But we didn't when I was a kid in the farm. they had doves. They kept them. They kept them. The Romans had a name for it, columbarium, a place where the columba was a Latin word for dove. We came across a place in excavation that we didn't understand. I still don't know for sure, but it looked like a letterbox, what you'd call pigeonholes. And I'm not sure what they were, pigeonholes, where it would be like a bird box, like a Martin house. Only the pigeons, of course, you just have these boxes that make nests in there. So yes, they had doves and pigeons. The difference between dove and pigeon is that the pigeon stays all year. The dove is migratory. And the dove is migratory. Both of them are good to eat, of course. But the migratory dove would come by the thousands. And so they were available. And of course, you could go and get one, and the poor person would go and find one. The rich person would say, go down to the market and get me a couple. But the rich person would have a lamb. A good point. Well, I think that's all that I need to say about that. These are the regulations. And I think the NIV translation does keep those distinctions that I made there. And I think adequately and well. Yes?
Practically speaking, what would happen? Well, what couldn't a person or a couple do if they were unclean?
Oh, they could live a normal life. They would not go out to the market that day. They would stay home, wash their hands. They'd wash their hands, wash body, whatever they'd wash, much of water as they had. And then they would be unclean until the evening. That didn't mean they couldn't eat. That didn't mean they couldn't go out the field, plow with their horses, their mule, or ox, whatever. It would mean that they would not go to the public territory. There wouldn't be any great deal to it. But anything else? I don't know. My guess is that she would, but that there would be some difference of opinion on the matter. You know today, of course, the Jews have these rules run to the ground. Not in Leviticus, but in Deuteronomy and Exodus, it says you must not cook a kid his mother's milk. I mentioned that the other day. And you know what they did with that? Here is meat and here is milk. You keep it separate. Well, you keep it separate. You can't even wash the same pan. You have different sets of pans for meat and for milk. You don't eat the same things together at the meal. There were some probably who would say, no, the woman shouldn't cook. But I think that doesn't say that they shouldn't cook around the house. There would be some limitations, but the main limitation would be don't touch other people. Notice the distinction that I made. No sacrifices. No sacrifices for normal marital intercourse.
But they're still unclean. They still have to be unclean. So the uncleanness, what you're saying, is purely hygienic.
Yeah. Well, not purely hygienic, but for that and that sort of thing. I did say what it would do, not for ordinary birth and so on, but for abnormal and sinful. There, it would prevent the prostitution that was so common, is so common, and have a real consequence there for good. Not much inconvenience as far as ordinary couple are concerned. Well, the details probably how it were applied in detail, I suppose, are beyond us, but these are the general rules. And I think that that's as far as we go. So the laws would be summarized in the laws of food, good diet, and that includes also no vermin, because not only what you eat, but what you touch after it's dead is included. So you're protected against bad food and protected against bad vermin. I mean, bugs and rats and mice in the house. And then also, you're protected against infectious diseases, quarantine, the principle of quarantine for infectious diseases, and for living conditions, the house with mildew. And another kind of disease, which is not a skin disease, but is an infectious disease. Diarrhea and so on. So it was a pretty complete public health arrangement. And again, the one point of water, washing, was a pretty good thing. Do you know the first steps toward the discovery of germs and skin diseases and so on? We think of Lister. Wasn't it Lister who was the one who discovered sepsis? But before that, there was a doctor down in Austria. I forget what his name was. This doctor down in Austria worked in a hospital that had been given by the Queen of Austria for women for childbirth. I think particularly for poor women, for childbirth. And the rate of death was awful. And women didn't want to go there. It was for free, you see. And women that were single or prostitute or whatnot were put there. And they didn't want to go there because of the reputation it had. And one doctor there got the idea that he should wash. They went from one patient to another, back and forth, you know. And he got the idea that between patients he should wash his hands in lime water. As he washed his hands in lime water, the patients, his patients didn't die. And he was blacklisted and everything. But he was on the track. And simple washing helped a great deal. He used lime water. For ancient times, they used soda for soap. They got it from the alkali lakes of Egypt. And Jeremiah says, "Oh, you wash your hands and day. Take much soap. Your iniquity is with you. The soap there was what we would call washing soda. And that was there, the cleanser.
Why would they let him?
Because it was very unorthodox. He had these queer ideas that nobody could explain. He had no idea of germs. They wouldn't look at the facts. And he retired, and I think retired more or less in disgrace. Did some of you, is Ignace, somebody was his name. You don't remember his name? You've heard the story.
Yeah.
Well, we still have a few minutes. Let's take our Hebrew Bibles and make a beginning on Leviticus 20. Now you see we turn to another subject. Chapter 16 of Leviticus is the theology of sacrifice. Now we're on, get to 4, we've finished the principles of cleanliness. Now we're on the holiness code, Leviticus 18 to 26. And I said we should look at Leviticus 20, first few verses. Mr. Zaspel, have you looked at these?
Yes.
Uh-huh. You went through a few verses anyhow. Suppose you take the first couple of verses.
We're supposed to know what to say.
Yes, that's a difficult verse. You can parse all those words, can you?
Call someone else out for verse 2.
Can you? What's that word, Moshe? Actual active cow participle of the... Okay. See if you can do number 2.
Speak of the sons of Israel. Any man of the sons of Israel, or of the sojourners who sojourn in Israel, who gives from his offspring to Molech, shall surely be put to death. Now the people of the land
should
put him to death.
Yeah, not just put him to death.
Regem.
What is Regem? Logem?
Stone
him. Stone him. Stone him to death. They say, you know, that the vocabulary of the Bible, don't think that this is your total Hebrew vocabulary. There are a lot of words they used in ancient times that are not in the Hebrew Bible. We only have a small portion of the words of the Hebrew language. We don't have much extra biblical Hebrew of ancient days. Inscriptions here and there, but not much. Saying is that if you learn your Bible well, you have a big enough vocabulary to stone prophets, but not enough to order your breakfast. Yes, you have this first phrase, ish, ish. I think you did that rightly. Any man. A man. That's just an idiom for it. Anybody. And understand, of course, ish there means anybody, not just male. Yes, any man of the Israelites, B'nai Israel, also means of the nation of Israel, or from the strangers. The Ger has certain rights too. Dr. Spicer, my teacher, University of Pennsylvania, he used to say that a Ger was like a man who had taken out first citizenship papers. He was part of the nation, but he wasn't really naturalized. He was kind of in between. Not a foreigner, exactly, but anybody living there. Legal resident, part of the nation. Yeah. Maybe not Israelite in antiquity, ancestry, but part of the nation. He was subject to the same rules. And if he didn't want to be subject to the same rules, well, he could get out. Because if he violated the rules, he'd get stoned. So he was subject to that rule, too. Now this question, from his seed to Molech. Who was Molech?
Yeah, me.
presumably it is a god to whom they offered their people sacrifice, wasn't it? There is a question whether it is Molech or whether it is a god Milk. Where do you suppose they would get the Holam Segol? Well, let me ask you another question. Why is Ish-Bosheth sometimes called Ish-Bosheth and sometimes called Ish-Baal? You realize that? Son of Saul, Ish-Bosheth. They say Adonai instead of Jehovah, or Yahweh, whatever it was pronounced, because it was too holy. Here it was too bad. So the thought is that Molech is with the vowels of Bosheth. Molech, Bosheth. So this may not be Molech at all. It may be a god Melech, because Melech, what does Melech mean? It's king. And the deity, name for the deity king, see, the god king. And so the phrase Molech is questionable. Now, of course, it may be Molech, I don't know. Albright discusses this extensively in his book, Yahweh and the Gods of Canaan. Have you know that book, Yahweh and the Gods of Canaan by Albright? It's not a big book, and it's written toward the end of his life. And it gives in there some of his interpretation of the religion of the Canaanites. It's a pretty valuable book. Like any such book, don't believe it all, but there's a good bit in there that's something to think about. And he was fully conversant with the Ugaritic literature and archaeological material and so on. So his word is worthy. Religion and the gods of Canaan. And he discusses this rather at length there. I don't have the pages. Yes.
So I asked a question about the other nations around, like boy sacrifice for children.
Yeah.
As far as like liberal theologians, it seems like there's quite a big difference between Israel not sacrificing for children and all the nations surrounding them.
Albright argues that there is not a deity Melech here, but that this refers to what he calls a royal sacrifice. The royal sacrifice would be like the king of Moab, who in time of great national distress, you know, he offered his son, hoping that the gods would be appeased and he would be delivered. And the Greeks also had this sort of thing. And, in a sense, it would be heroic. This one would be, give up one man for the nation, you see. In a sense, it's substitutionary atonement. So he says it is the sacrifice of the king, the highest sacrifice. Now, there was also, whether connected with this or not, there was also, of course, the business of child sacrifice, and that went rampant among the Phoenicians. They have found in Carthage, in later days, Carthage, a Phoenician colony, they have found the burials of hundreds of children where their bones were burned. And pretty clearly, child sacrifice in a big way. And whether it was unwanted children or children that were given in devotion or false devotion or what, hard to tell. But it gets pretty gruesome like that. And of course, remember that the kings of Israel did that, caused their children to pass through the fire, is the word. And I think the parallel here in Leviticus 2 Deuteronomy uses the expression pass through the fire. So whatever it was certainly a heathen custom. But now I ask the question, what is wrong with human sacrifice? First you say, well, of course, everything's wrong with human sacrifice. Well, don't be too quick. What is wrong with human sacrifice? Here is a king of Moab in desperate condition, and his nation is about to fall. And in hopes that he can deliver his nation, he gives his oldest son. That's heroic. And the son steps up, says, yes, Father, I will do it for the good of the nation. Well, a man does that in battle. Why, you give him a Purple Heart and everything. And so there is a sense. Bad? Was it good? Well, the answer, of course, is it was bad for various reasons. Maybe in some cases it might not have been bad in intent, but it was certainly bad in execution for two reasons. It was offered to the wrong God. That we must say. And secondly, though it was the best the king had, it wasn't good enough. Because no man is good enough to take away our sin. So human sacrifice, in a sense, may be thought of as man's best effort to save himself and his people. But man's best effort is an abomination in the eyes of God. And the man who does it be stoned. Now, in a sense, you know, I like to think of this in connection with the sacrifice of Isaac. Abraham learned a big lesson when he learned that God would provide lamb for the sacrifice. Not Isaac. Not Moses, not Paul. But God would provide lamb for the sacrifice, a perfect lamb. This sacrifice was an evil sacrifice. All sacrifices to false God were evil sacrifices. And this, perhaps, the worst because, in a sense, was the best. So here we have at least the sacrifice. See how it is condemned. Moth, yumath, you got that right, of course. This is infinitive absolute plus finite verb, isn't it? And it makes it emphatic, of course. You're stoning with stones. Yes, and I will give my face, verse 3, and I will give my face against that man, and I will cut him off from the midst of my people, because from his seed he gave to Molech in order, on account of the uncleanness, on account of he defiled my sanctuary, and to defile my holy name. Profane my holy name. The Hallel infinitive and Tamei infinitive and so on. I guess no particular comment. We don't have time for any more. That third verse, anything you had, Mr. Zaspel, that didn't cover any questions? No. Straightforward Hebrew there. Okay, I had assigned to verse 13, hadn't I? We'll finish the rest of the verses next time, and go on with this matter of the holiness code. And you should kind of familiarize yourself with especially those two chapters, 18 and 20. I want to look at 18 and 20 particularly, and check all the different sins that are there listed. Okay. But see you next week.
Are there some no extra translations?
No, I think not this time.